You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll find out how the coronavirus has shaken up the working world here in Wisconsin and how it made some existing problems even worse. First, the novel coronavirus continues to spread, with Wisconsin and other states routinely reporting hundreds of new cases every day. And the number of COVID-19 deaths in the United States has been on the rise for the first time in a couple of months. Our next guest reports that there's a big disconnect between how the public is perceiving the threat of COVID-19 and what public health officials are saying. That has many people in the medical community worried about how well-equipped the country is to handle the weeks and months ahead. Reed Wilson is a national correspondent at The Hill and author of the book Epidemic, Ebola, and the Global Scramble to Prevent the Next Killer Outbreak. He's been reporting on COVID-19 around the U.S. Reed, good to have you back with us.
Hey, thanks for having me, Rob.
You wrote this piece on the disconnect between the public and public health people a couple weeks ago, and since then we've seen the number of deaths going up in the country. Has this disconnect stayed just as bad as it was?
I mean, it's getting worse almost. You just heard the tagline there on the end of the hourly newscast that the number of deaths had surpassed 150,000. 150,000 people is just a stunning toll. And we keep having these conversations about reopening the Major League Baseball and when we're going back to school and when we can get back to normal. Normal has changed. And it's, you know, I don't want to be alarmist. I don't want to sound the sort of worst case scenarios. But I wrote the piece because I really felt like we're not appreciating the fact that our lives have changed now and will be changed for the foreseeable future until there is a widely distributed, widely available vaccine that is effective in stopping this virus. I mean, 100,000 people. Think about it like this. President Trump is in Midland, Texas today. Midland, Texas has a population of about 146,000. More Americans have died of the coronavirus than the entire population of the town where the president is today.
It's not just you that feels this disconnect. You talk to a bunch of public health officials who are scratching their heads trying to figure out why the situation that's looking so dire from where they're sitting has a bunch of the public thinking, how do we get back to normal? When can we do this?
Yeah, and in conversations with these public health experts around the country, you know, I tend to go back to the same 10 or 15 experts once a week or something like that, just to check in and see what's new. And a lot of them, like the conversations that we've been having lately, feel like the same conversations that we were having in March and April. And that's because they are. We know how to stop this virus. It requires social distancing. It requires wearing a mask and constant hand sanitizer and staying at home as much as possible and doing everything we possibly can to avoid being in settings where the virus might spread. And yet we're not doing it. As a society, it feels like we're letting our guard down. More and more I hear more and more people talking about spreading at bars. I mean, people are going to bars in the midst of this and having loud conversations and standing too close to other people and things like that. In talking to a lot of public health experts lately, it's clear the virus is spreading among social circles. So people, especially younger people under the age of 35, maybe even under the age of 30, are now accounting for higher and higher percentage of this case. And that tells you that basically people are trying to get back to normal. Well, we're not back to normal. And it's sort of like, this is painful and it really isn't fun. And it's really awful to go through. But the alternative is not only getting the coronavirus oneself, if you go to a bar or a place where a lot of people hang out, but maybe even spreading it to other people. And, you know, maybe you or I wouldn't have terrible symptoms if we got it. But then again, maybe we spread it to somebody who would, somebody who's got an underlying condition, somebody who is older. Like, we're practicing this vigilance, not just for ourselves, but for the people around us, and to stop this so that we can get back to normal more quickly. But that more quickly is not a couple of weeks. It's probably not even a couple of months. It's a substantial period of time before life is going to get back to normal.
On the other side of the trend, I mean, there's still polling showing a lot of people are wearing masks out and about. A lot of people are taking the social distancing seriously. Then we're seeing announcements from companies like Google saying, yeah, we're sticking with working from home until June of 2021 at this point. There are still people out there, people and organizations taking this seriously.
Yeah, there are. And more Americans are wearing masks. We're starting to see people taking this seriously. And in talking to a lot of the public health experts, I spent yesterday on the phone with epidemiologists in about six states, the state epidemiologists. They're saying that they're seeing a lot more people taking this seriously, largely because they think that more people know somebody who's gotten this disease. And if you get it, it's not going to be fun. It is very clearly not the flu. It's a very serious disease. And even the low intensity cases can drag on for weeks or months. And so, and by the way, months, there are people who have literally suffered from this disease for multiple months now. So that tells you that, you know, we're still in the midst of this. People are taking it more seriously, but we've got to get a lot of people to take it very seriously if we want things to return to normal. There are countries in Europe and Asia where they have suppressed the virus to the extent to which they've just had, you know, a few dozen, maybe 100 cases on a given day. I'm about 50 miles down the road from a town of 2,000 people who have had 100 cases in the last 4 days. So, I mean, it's very clearly out of control in the United States, and we still have to take it as seriously as it is.
Talking to Reed Wilson, national correspondent at The Hill, about a disconnect between public health officials and experts and their concerns about COVID-19 and the public maybe not taking it as seriously. Reed, what are some of the reasons out there for why at least a substantial portion of the public it still isn't taking this seriously?
Well, it's hard. I mean, let's be honest here. It's really hard to lock yourself in an apartment or your house for months on end. A lot of people have lost their jobs. A lot of people have lost income. Something like half of American households have at least lost some income during this. So the economy is going to suffer. It's not fun to be away from friends and family. So they're all completely understandable reasons why people would be just absolutely sick of these lockdowns and staying at home voluntarily even. But the fact is, you've got to take it seriously. There are some people spreading misinformation about the virus itself, about treatments that don't actually work. And I almost think that comes from a good place too. Like they're trying to get past this, and they're maybe it's a misguided attempt, but they're making an attempt to put this whole thing behind us and find some kind of cure. But we're not at the cure yet. We're not at the vaccine yet. We're making amazing progress on the scientific side. There are 25 vaccine candidates that are in clinical trials. There are about 200 to 250 more vaccine candidates that haven't reached the clinical phase yet. But, you know, those trials take time, and we're not there yet. So we have to do the really hard work now to make sure that we're not just protecting ourselves, but we're protecting those who are vulnerable in the rest of our community.
Wanted to ask you, Reed, about the morale of the public health experts you've talked to, especially, you know, we had this stretch where we looked like we had this in hand or just about. The numbers, the case numbers were going down, the deaths numbers had gone way down, things were looking pretty good, and now the case numbers went up, now the death numbers are starting to go up along with that. What are they thinking as they see this thing rebound?
Well, they're tired, they're frustrated, and they're really looking for new ways to communicate, because when they repeat the same message again and again, even if it's the correct information, people sort of, you know, their eyes glaze over. Okay, this is not new information. Our minds are primed for the new, right, rather than repeating the old. That's why we're terrified of shark attacks, but we don't pay attention to, you know, car accidents that kill 50,000 Americans every year. If something is new, it's going to grab our attention. So right now, public health experts are looking for that new message, the new way to communicate both the urgency and the information, the information that we need to actually protect ourselves and stay healthy. They are frustrated with this apparent just lack of concern and the acceptance of what is basically a culture of disease and death. That's our alternative here. I mean, we can choose to do the really hard work that keeps people safe, or we can accept tens of thousands of more Americans dying. And, I don't know about you, I think it's a pretty clear choice.
And Reed, before we wrap up, where are you watching around the country now? What signs are you looking for? I know you kind of watch state by state.
Yeah, we've seen some disturbing signs in places like Las Vegas, places like, Denver, St. Louis was recently on the uptick. And then, you know, scary enough, we're starting to see some models showing the case growth in the Northeast, the one region of the country that feels like it's got this thing under control. New York City is starting to tick up a little bit. Baltimore, Maryland is one of the emerging hotspots. And even places like the Jersey Shore and Hartford, Connecticut, places like that. That being said, those are just the hotspots. This thing is spreading broadly through the community, just about every part of the country.
Reed, thanks for joining us again.
Sorry to be such a pessimist, Rob.
That's all right. Reed Wilson is a national correspondent at The Hill, author of the book Epidemic, Ebola and the Global Scramble to Prevent the Next Killer Outbreak. He talked with us about a disconnect between medical experts and the public on the current state of the COVID-19 pandemic. Coming up, a new report digs into the state of working Wisconsin at a tough time in the nation's economy. The author of that report brings us the details coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Attorney General William Barr faced a lot of tough questions from Democrats and support from Republicans when he testified on a variety of topics yesterday on Capitol Hill. We'll review some of the back and forth, among other top Washington stories, with a White House reporter. First, the policy group COWS has issued its annual State of Working Wisconsin report for 2020. The report this year paints a tough portrait of the state of jobs, working, and workers statewide. Issues that have been present for years, including significant racial disparities in the workforce, are still part of the picture, and the recent COVID-19 outbreak has made the working situation worse for many in Wisconsin. The pandemic has left a lot of people either without work or having to find alternatives as the virus has shifted where and how people do their jobs. Laura Dresser is the author of the report. She's a labor economist and associate director of COWS. Laura, welcome back to the show.
I'm really happy to be here.
Well, this report comes in a different year, and you're doing it a little differently to account for what kind of impact COVID-19 has had. Big picture, how has this disease affected working life in Wisconsin?
Well, I think there's one way to think about it, right? Which is that work is fundamentally transformed. Everybody has experienced some change in their work from this pandemic. And that's especially true of the people who lost their jobs. Unemployment is at a level we haven't seen in, it spiked to a level we hadn't seen in decades and is now still very high. But also for the people who, through coworkers and customers, are exposed to the virus, work has changed. And for those who have been able to stay in their houses and be protected in their work, but now they're working in their houses. And so I feel like it's a big year for a sense of how changed work is.
A theme of your report, though, is while it's affected everybody, it hasn't affected everybody equally. And you make the case in the report that people who already had problems, whether because of pay disparities, job disparities, racial disparities, whatever, were harder hit. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, absolutely. If you think about those categories I just named, unemployed, exposed through work, and those who can work at home, that isn't distributed evenly across demographics. It is, in fact, the case that the people who are unemployed, concentrated in leisure and hospitality, workers at lower wages with lower benefits in the first places, more likely to be unemployed, to lose their work entirely. Those are the hardest hit sectors. So more likely to be women, more likely to be Black and brown workers. That's the front line of the unemployment. And then you look at the exposed workers, people who have jobs that put them in touch through customers and coworkers. Again, this tends to be, there's some high level wage work in that category, of course, doctors and nurses sort of famously, but there's also a lot of very low wage work here. From frontline work in nursing homes to grocery stores to transit provision, the people who move goods and people and the necessities of our lives are all exposed in their work. And many of them are working in low wage jobs with very poor health insurance and very little protection for the protections, inadequate protections to keep them safe from the disease. Then for the more privileged people who can work in their homes, that looks more, that's a sort of luxury to be able to work out of your home, get your paycheck. Those workers look more privileged in all the other ways, right? So just in how it's changed work, the inequality that started in the work is sort of exacerbated, exposed and exacerbated by the restructuring that COVID has done.
One of the last times we had you on the show was to talk about the Race in the Heartland report. Can you dig a little more into the racial inequities we already had in Wisconsin's economy and how those have shaped up during COVID-19?
Yeah, this is such an important theme to grapple with, especially this summer, as the nation and each city, and this state stare hard and really consider and reckon with the racial disparities that we have too long tolerated. Race in the Heartland, our report on racial inequality for the state, really just demonstrated that Wisconsin is consistently among the worst states in the nation, we said, from the birth to the ballot box, whether you look at income or school outcomes or infant and maternal mortality or home ownership, the distance between what Black people in this state experience and what white people in this state experience is the largest in the nation. That was true before the coronavirus came. And that was true before the coronavirus generated sickness in the Black and brown community at three times the rate of the white community and death at twice the rate of the white community. So you see the disparity in the health outcomes. There was just the most recent month of data, the Black unemployment actually went up as white unemployment came down. That's nationally. We don't have race disparity specifics in this for the state yet in Corona on the economic indicators, but we know that the inequality was among the worst in the nation, and we know that nationally the inequality is increasing, and so we have to really focus on extending opportunity to Black workers, protecting the workers at the bottom of the labor market, protecting Black workers, and both in terms of health and rights on the job.
Talking to Laura Dresser, Associate Director of the group COWS, about their new report on the state of working Wisconsin, especially during COVID-19. Laura, looking at possible solutions, I think all along there's been kind of a talk like, okay, we're going to hurt the economy by shutting down and stopping COVID, or no, we need to put health before that economic interest. If I'm reading your report right, you say we can't really separate the two.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's one of the illusions is that somehow the shutdown orders is what's making the economies not work, not the virus itself. The original problem is the virus. And I think this is really demonstrated well in Sweden. Sweden took a completely different approach to the coronavirus. They had much less regulated shutdown. And they had, as a result, much higher death rates than their Northern European kind of neighbors, much higher death rates. But when you look at the shrinkage of their economy shrunk almost as much as their neighbors, 5 to 7% down. That's because what people are responding to is that there's a coronavirus, right? Like, people don't want to go out to eat. The problem isn't the rule to shut down the restaurant. The problem is that there is danger outside and people are not going to go to a restaurant. So that separating, pretending that the orders to change behavior actually are the problem, not an attempt to get towards a solution, I think is a sort of diversion. Economies are going to shrink as long as this virus is live and out there. And the more it is allowed to grow and, you know, kind of reach more people, the more people that are going to stay inside. So the economic cost comes alongside with the virus, not necessarily only with the orders about what to do about it.
Now, you've been doing this report for something on the order of 25 years or so. That includes a couple, I think, little recessions and the Great Recession. How does this economic downturn stack up just looking at the numbers here in Wisconsin?
I mean, 25 years is a long time to kind of revisit annually the state of working Wisconsin and to see the way it changes. I mean, I think that, anybody who's really been watching the economy has never seen contraction like we had from March to April. Nearly 500,000 jobs in the state disappeared across that month. We've had very strong months of recovery the 2 months since. So we're only down, now I'm saying only down 300,000 jobs right now relative to the 500 before. I mean, that kind of jobs hole is along the line of or greater than anything we had in the Great Recession. And looking forward, we see both promise and threats, and it's hard to know which way things go. But this is an intense and rapid and historic contraction, giant displacement of workers. And many of the unemployed workers, spiking up to 14%, but even above 8% in the last report, and new data will come out next month. Nearly one in 10 people who want to be working are looking for jobs and not able to secure them. It's a really high level of unemployment, and it's such a sudden shift. So it feels totally different. That's part of the reason we've sort of changed the way we're approaching the report, because often I'm reporting on data that's a year old. And right now, I don't feel like anybody would really want to hear what was going on in 2019, because it was sort of a different world.
Yeah, it's like the Great Recession was a series of dominoes falling one at a time. And this seems like we just dumped the whole box of dominoes on the floor.
Yeah, I think that's one way to see it. And the dominoes are all kind of have stuff on them, so you have to clean them with hand sanitizer.
Exactly. Now, what are you, in our last minute and a half or so, Laura, what are you watching for next? What do you have your eyes on most closely?
Well, here are some things. I mean, obviously, we're all watching the trajectories on the disease, the ability to, get the curve bent down and all that. And I think we're all looking to what happens in town, in Madison, when students return. We have the increase in the density and a lot of young people I think that's important to watch. But also at the state level, thinking about what the federal government is going to do about unemployment insurance. We had a good, strong, generous response, but that runs out at the end of the month. And really, workers need something, the workers that can't find jobs. And thinking about federal support to state and local government, because state and local receipts are down, the demand for services is up, and there needs to be a federal answer on that one, too. So I would say I'm looking at all those things, and we'll be keeping an eye. And this will the website will be updated with new jobs data when it comes out and new reports on specific occupations and worker profiles all the way across.
Laura, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Laura Dresser is a labor economist and the associate director of the group COWS. She joined us today to talk about the group's latest State of Working Wisconsin report, which looks at jobs and income in the state and how work has been impacted by the COVID-19 pandemic. Coming up after the news, we'll look at the latest on Senate Republicans' plans for coronavirus relief, among other top Washington news stories. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, an assembly of utility companies, environmentalists, and consumer groups is out with a list of recommendations on how Wisconsin can transition to clean power in the future. We'll find out what they're hoping to see. First, it's the week in Washington with a look at some of the week's top national political stories. Attorney General William Barr made an appearance yesterday on Capitol Hill facing a barrage of questions, mainly from Democrats, about his and the administration's handling of protests around the country, coronavirus, and parts of the Russia Mueller investigation. Barr and Republicans pushed back, saying that federal agents have been lawfully required to protect federal property in states and cities where Democratic leadership didn't do enough to look after that property. You can join in on that topic at 800-642-1234. Did you watch or hear any of the Barr hearing yesterday? What thoughts did you have? And what do you think about the use of federal law enforcement agents in American cities in response to protests? Should they be there or not? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Tulu Olorunipa is the White House reporter for The Washington Post. Tulu, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Rob.
Well, let's start with that testimony from the Attorney General yesterday in front of the House Judiciary Committee. Set us up with kind of the tone of this whole thing.
Well, this was a long-awaited hearing in that Attorney General Barr has been Attorney General for more than a year and a half, and he had not sat before the House Judiciary Committee all year. They've been trying to get him since last year, and for whatever reason they hadn't been able to get him, and it was long expected to be a contentious hearing. In previous hearings, Barr has been very flippant with some of the lawmakers. He's been unwilling to give them what they want. He has, in some cases, in the words of some of the lawmakers, been rude and pompous towards them, and that was expected. And Democratic lawmakers who run this committee were, you know, planning to, were sort of expecting that from Barr, and then they sort of used their powers as congressmen and congresswomen to cut him off from time to time when they thought maybe he wasn't answering their questions, or he was obfuscating, or he was trying to score political points. They would say, you know, reclaiming my time, and they would cut him off. And that's really how this whole hearing went. There are a lot of issues on which the Democrats and the Republicans are very far apart, ranging from Barr's handling of the Mueller investigation to how Barr treated some of President Trump's allies who got lighter sentences than they might not than they might have if they were not allies of the president, to how he's handled some of these protests and cracking down on peaceful protesters both in Washington, D.C. and other places across the country, using federal forces to do so. So there was a lot of areas of disagreement, and for that reason, the hearing was very contentious, and there were a lot of sparks flying for the, you know, for the entire course of the hearing, which lasted several hours.
Let's dive into one of those many points of agreement. Here's Democratic Representative Pramila Jayapal from Washington State. She'd been accusing the attorney general of an excessive use of force against protesters in Lafayette Park as compared to protests in Michigan's capital around opening the state back up. Here's a listen.
You take an aggressive approach to Black Lives Matter protests, but not to right-wing extremists threatening to lynch a governor if it's for the Trump's, if it's for the president's benefit. Did I get it right, Mr. Barr?
I have responsibility for the federal government, and the White House is the seat of the executive
branch. Mr. Barr, let
me
just make it clear. You are supposed to represent
authorities
the people of the United States of America, not violate people's First Amendment rights. You are supposed to uphold democracy and secure equal justice under the law, not violently dismantle certain protesters based on the president's personal agenda.
Gentlelady's time is expired.
So a lot of disagreement there. Republicans on the committee had backed up how the attorney general and the president had handled protests. Talk a little more about this issue and some of the back and forth we heard.
Yeah, the two parties are very far apart on this issue of these protests. Republicans wanted to drive home this idea that Democrats wanted to defund the police, and that Barr and the Trump administration were standing up for law and order, and that all that they were doing and trying to contain and control these protests were to make sure that people were not being victimized, that businesses were not being vandalized, that federal property was not being, you know, destroyed or decimated. On the other side, we had Democrats who said this was a clear violation of Americans' constitutional rights to freedom of assembly, freedom of speech, the ability to, you know, go about their lives and protest their government without being attacked by, in many cases, unmarked federal officials who did not identify themselves, who were operating under sort of a hard to understand or hard to define command and control structure. And they pressed them pretty hard, especially looking at the difference between how some of the protests that took place in several states like Michigan over the shutdowns in April and May, how some of those protests were unruly and did include people who had arms and who essentially shut down the Michigan State House because they were going in with guns. And the federal response to that was very muted. President Trump actually sort of egged on those protesters, saying, you know, Michigan needed to be liberated. But when the protest shifted to, you know, issues of police violence, issues of police brutality, racial injustice, then President Trump and his Justice Department decided to crack down and send in their forces to, you know, essentially try to quash some of these protests. So you heard Democrats make a lot of hay about that, especially about that June 1st photo op where the president walked across Lafayette Square after federal agents had used pepper spray and tear gas on peaceful protesters to clear the park right across the street from the White House. And then minutes later, the president walked over to a church for a photo op holding a Bible. Attorney General Barr was very much involved in that. He directed much of that, and he was brought to task during the hearing for his role in that process. And he tried to defend himself and say that It wasn't because of the photo op that, you know, the protesters were dispersed, but he faced a lot of tough questioning on that issue specifically.
So our weekly look at some of the top stories in national politics. Tolu Olorunipa is with us from the Washington Post. He covers the White House right now, talking about Attorney General William Barr testifying before the House Judiciary Committee. You can join in at 800-642-1234. One of the big issues there, the use of federal law enforcement agents from various Homeland Security agencies against protesters, vandals in cities, especially Portland, Seattle, and elsewhere, it looks like. You can join in with your reactions to that. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Tolu, as you mentioned, another issue that came up here had to do with the Mueller probe, Roger Stone, Michael Flynn. Going back to the impeachment hearings, Russia, Barr was accused of making decisions or getting involved in these cases. I want to give a listen to the Attorney General being questioned here by Democratic Representative Eric Swalwell from California.
The prosecutors wanted me to play Judas. I refused. Are you familiar with that Stone statement?
Actually, I'm not.
So how can you sit here and tell us why should I investigate the President of the United States if you're not even aware of the facts concerning the President using the pardon or commutation power to swap the silence of a witness?
Because we require a reliable predicate before we open a criminal investigation.
And I just gave to you, sir.
I don't consider it. I consider it a very Rube Goldberg theory that you had.
Well, it sounds like you're hearing this evidence
and
for the
by
first
the way,
time
if
today.
I applied, if I applied this standard, General, there'd be a lot more people under investigation.
And so they're referring there to the commutation of Roger Stone's sentence after he had said, in effect, I didn't roll over on the president. Was this a big part of yesterday's hearings, Tolu?
It did become a big part of the hearings because the lawmakers wanted, especially on the Democratic side, wanted to question how the Justice Department handled some of these investigations that involved friends and allies of the president. It did appear that Barr interfered in a number of these cases, specifically for Roger Stone, where the line prosecutors wanted to recommend a sentence of 7 to 9 years for his several, you know, felony counts of witness tampering, obstructing justice, lying to Congress. They said that was within the guidelines. President Trump tweeted about it when he heard about it. He said that was a disgrace. And lo and behold, hours later, Attorney General Barr pulled that recommendation and essentially said that he would not stand by that recommendation and that a lower recommendation for a shorter sentence was warranted. And the Justice Department under Barr also moved to drop charges against Michael Flynn, who had pleaded guilty twice to lying to investigators. And those are both allies of the president who were involved in his 2016 campaign. So he faced a lot of questions over why the Justice Department appeared to be interfering in a way that benefited the president's friends and allies and did not make it seem like everyone was equal in the eyes of the law. And he faced pretty tough questions from the Democrats about that. He faced questions from Republicans who essentially tried to back up the president's claims that his campaign was the victim of a spying campaign and that the Justice Department and the FBI was arrayed against the president's campaign in 2016 and tried to take him down. And some Republicans wanted him, wanted Barr and the Justice Department to be tougher on that issue, even though there's not really a lot of evidence to back up those claims, those sort of conspiratorial claims about a broad spying conspiracy against the Trump campaign. But it seems like even though we're 4 years past the 2016 campaign, we are still talking about allegations and in some cases, you know, convicted crimes that happened in the course of the 2016 campaign.
We're talking with Washington Post White House reporter Tolu Olorunipa. It's the Week in Washington. We're looking at some of the week's top stories in national politics. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you'd like, coming up, we'll look at Senate Republicans advancing a plan for another round of coronavirus relief. Different than the House Democrat plan, of course. We'll get the latest and find out how far they are apart. You can join them with your hopes on that at 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Washington Post White House reporter Tolu Olorunipa, looking at some of the top stories in national politics. Tolu, this long-running saga now of if there's going to be a new round from Congress of coronavirus economic relief, a new chapter now, Senate Republicans releasing what they want to do. What are we seeing there?
Well, right now we see not much that looks anything like a deal. People have essentially run up to the deadline in which they're losing their added unemployment benefits. That is a key sticking point, that extra $600 that unemployed Americans were receiving. That expires in a matter of hours, and there's no deal right now between the Republicans and Democrats about what to do about that or other issues. Now, the Republicans did roll out their bill earlier this week. Essentially, they're calling for a reduction in unemployment benefits, taking it down from that $600 federal enhancement down to $200 for the next couple of months, and then a formula after that based on what people were earning before they were unemployed. Democrats are saying that's a non-starter. They say that Americans need much more money to keep the bills paid, keep a roof over their heads. Republicans also want things like liability protection, something that the Democrats aren't too happy about. There are some areas where the two sides are in agreement. Both sides want to continue giving another round of $1,200 stimulus payments to Americans like they did back in March. Both sides want to make sure that there's money for schools to reopen, for schools to have extra funding so that they can reopen safely. Democrats want money for state and local governments. Republicans did not put any money in there. And there are a couple of other issues in the Republican bill that are just sort of head scratching and confusing because they don't seem to be related in any way to the coronavirus pandemic. There was $1.75 billion in there for an FBI building that it happens to be across the street from President Trump's hotel in Washington. There's not a lot of support for renovating that building there. There was a push to have it moved to another location. But by having it kept there, if this bill were to pass as is, President Trump would be able to, you know, have a nice, beautiful new building next to his hotel and also keep out other hotels or other competition from there. So how that got snuck into the bill, even some Republicans aren't sure and don't seem to be defending it. But that is one of the reasons why we are so far apart from a deal, is because both sides have very different versions of what they think the country needs in this final bill, what is likely to be the final bill before the August recess and full-blown campaigning starts. And right now the negotiations are happening, but there doesn't seem to be a lot of movement.
Is there any thought, and I think everybody's trying to avoid this, but a thought that there would just be a straight, hey, we're going to boost unemployment benefits, at least some portion of them, and that's it? We're just going to take a clean vote on something like that?
Well, earlier on, that there was a lot of opposition to that on both sides. They did not want a piecemeal approach. They wanted to try to get everything done at once. But it seems that now that the talks are breaking down and there's not a lot of movement and progress, and the deadline is fast approaching, it does seem like that may be an option that both sides can get along with. The Republicans, a large number of Republicans, are still against the idea of giving people an extra $600. But I think if it were put up for a vote today, it would be likely that it would pass, just because, you know, people don't want to be in an election year seen as the votes who took away, you know, a lifeline from tens of millions of Americans who are, you know, right now relying on this extra money. But I do think that is more likely now than it was even 48 hours ago, just because they had thought they would be able to come up with some kind of a negotiation, but then the negotiations are largely stalled. And if it's going to be several weeks before they can come up with a bill, that is out of sync with the timeline for these unemployment benefits, which are essentially expiring as we speak.
Talking to Tolu Olorunipa from The Washington Post. It's our weekly look at the top stories in national news. Well, a big story under the radar, Tolu, this presidential election that seems to be going on. I understand you are in the midst of taking a look at some of the latest polling. What and where do you have your eye on?
Well, all across the country. We're looking at national polls. We're looking at swing states. Wisconsin is a hugely important swing state. Obviously, Michigan and Pennsylvania are also going to be important. North Carolina, Arizona, and Florida are the other three that we're looking very closely at. One thing I've been talking to some Trump campaign officials about is that they don't believe the polls. Right now, all the polls show Biden, former Vice President Joe Biden, beating President Trump pretty handily in a large number of these swing states and up double digits nationally. What we're hearing from the Trump campaign is that they believe that there is a hidden Trump vote out there, specifically in places like Wisconsin, where pollsters aren't really capturing the energy behind the Trump supporters, the people who are enthusiastically supporting the president, who maybe not speaking to pollsters about it, maybe not even telling their family, but when they get into the voting booth, they will support and vote for the president. So we have seen an enthusiasm gap in which people who are voting for President Trump are more enthusiastic about it. People who are voting for Vice President Biden are not as enthusiastic about voting for Biden, but they are pretty enthusiastic about voting against Trump. So it's been very interesting to see how that dynamic has played out. President Trump yesterday was talking about his approval ratings yesterday and sort of lamenting the fact that he does not have very high approval rating for his handling of the coronavirus. And he essentially just said, you know, it must be because of my personality. And that is what we're seeing in some of the polling, is that, you know, the American people do not like the chaos. They do not like sort of the bully type personality, the reality star in the White House. They may have been able to tolerate it before, but now that we're in the midst of very serious crises with a pandemic and with an economic downturn, we've seen the president's numbers go down because, you know, voters are not supporting how he's been handling this situation.
I want to take our last couple of minutes on a story you covered last week, Tolu, and now there's an update today. You'd written about the president tweeting, targeting, in his words, suburban housewives of America, talking about Joe Biden, he says, is a threat to the suburbs. And then today, the president saying he's getting rid of an Obama-era housing discrimination requirement. I'm going to quote from the pair of tweets here. I am happy to inform all of the people living their suburban lifestyle dream that you will no longer be bothered or financially hurt by having low-income housing built in your neighborhood. Your housing prices will go up based on the market, and crime will go down. I have rescinded the Obama-Biden AFFH rule. Enjoy. End quote there. Tolu, what's going on?
Yeah, this is a very clear election year ploy. The president thinks, president sees the numbers that show him losing in the suburbs. This is a very key part of the electorate who has traditionally gone with Republicans. 4 years ago, went with Republicans. Now they seem to be trending away from the president. So he has sort of doubled down on this approach that he's going to focus on suburban housing and what are pretty thinly veiled racial code words about, you know, suburban housewives and low income housing, essentially saying that he does not want, you know, minorities in low income apartments moving into the suburbs. And he's going to protect the suburbs while Joe Biden is going to destroy the suburbs. I think even earlier this week, he talked about how Cory Booker, the, you know, one of only a few black senators, was going to be in charge of housing in the suburbs, which there's no evidence or no indication that that Cory Booker would be involved in that. But essentially, the president is really reaching for a lot of these dog whistles, and he thinks that's a way that he will be able to appeal to suburban voters who he's going to need in Wisconsin, in Michigan, in Pennsylvania if he's going to be able to win. And right now, the polls show him behind, and this is his strategy for trying to approach this issue.
In our last, on just under a minute, Tolu, what are you watching for in the week to come?
I'll be watching very closely how the rest of the country responds to the coronavirus. We have seen the baseball that's tried to come back, and then there was an outbreak with the Marlins. Basketball's supposed to be coming back. Schools are supposed to be reopening, but we still see this virus as an impediment to all of that. And there are a number of different signals that we'll be watching for over the next week to see if the positivity rate starts to decrease, or if we stay at this level, it'll be hard to see any kind of return to normal, and that can impact the election in November.
Tolu, thanks again for joining us today.
You got it. Thank you.
We've been talking to Tolu Olorunipa. He covers the White House for the Washington Post. He joined us again this week for our roundup of some of the top stories making news in national politics, including Attorney General William Barr testifying yesterday before the House Judiciary Committee, plus a look at some of the latest presidential polling around the country and more. You can still share some of your thoughts on what the Attorney General had to say yesterday. And if you're paying attention to another story that's been going on today, top technology officials and social media companies, leaders testifying before a congressional committee themselves. We'll be talking about that in the days to come, and you can share your thoughts. Do you think that Congress should be doing more things to regulate some of those technology companies, the Amazons and Googles and Facebooks of the world? If so, what would you like to see change? email us, ideas@WPR.org, or tweet us on one of those platforms, ideas@centraltimewpr. I just grilled last night. Maybe you did too. Not too out of the ordinary, right? A lot of people have cookouts this time of year in Wisconsin. But one thing I didn't grill yesterday, and I bet you didn't either, a 200-pound hamburger. As reported in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, the annual Burger Fest in Seymour is mostly canceled, unfortunately, this time of year because of coronavirus. One tradition, though, that will still happen on August 8th is the grilling of this giant super burger. The 200-pound patty ends up providing apparently over 500 burgers each year. This year, those burgers are going to go to first responders and other essential workers. Seymour's Burger Fest marks the city's claim to be the home of the hamburger. And this year marks the 150th birthday of the Seymour man who sold beef on bread at the Outagamie County Fair. There are other claimants to the title of birthplace of the hamburger in Ohio, in Texas, in Brazil, and in Hamburg, Germany. But we're in Wisconsin, so it's Seymour. End of story. Now, if you want to try making a 200-pound hamburger at home, I think you're going to need a bigger grill. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.